call tonight's talk "Goodbye, Cruel Aggregates." Is seeking enlightenment selfish? This was a question that was raised by someone recently. Apparently there are some people who take the view that we can and must first bring an end to all external suffering in the world before working on ourselves. Now, is that possible? I don't think there's anyone in the world who would disagree with the fact that there is suffering in life. We're just hearing recently, actually, that they're struggling in Mongolia because they're having to deal with minus 40 degree temperatures, which, considering the fact that they had an incredibly dry summer in which not enough fodder was grown for their cattle, means that now all the cattle is dying off in Mongolia in these minus temperatures. Suffering is everywhere in life, whether it's external, or there's the Haiti earthquake, the Chile earthquake, whether it's disease. With inwardly, it's psychological suffering. There's so many people that seem to have psychological problems in the world these days. Everyone understands that there is suffering in life. And everyone agrees that there has to be a cessation of that suffering. And so much work and enterprise goes into trying to help others, in trying to bring relief to all the problems in the world. However, there is some disagreement about the causes of suffering and the ways of overcoming it. There is a law. It's called the Law of Unforeseeable Consequences. And I found a little story on the internet that portrays this law very well. In the early 1950s, the Dayak people of Borneo suffered from malaria. The World Health Organization had a solution, and it sprayed large amounts of DDT to kill the mosquitoes that carried the malaria. The mosquitoes died, the malaria declined. So far, so good. But there were side effects. Among the first was that the roofs of people's houses began to fall down on their heads. It seemed that the DDT was also killing a parasitic wasp that had previously controlled thatch-eating caterpillars. Worse, the DDT poisoned insects were eaten by geckos, which were eaten by cats. The cats started to die out. The rats flourished. And the people were threatened by potential outbreaks of typhus and the plague. So in trying to get rid of malaria, the World Health Organization created an outbreak of typhus and the plague. Unforeseeable consequences. And just to round the story off, the WHO, in order to try and combat this new problem, parachuted 14,000 live cats into Borneo. And when I first read that, I thought, how did they teach the cats to pull the ripcord? But I've been since advised that it was probably done in some other way. Now, this is very pertinent to the way Buddhism looks at this whole problem of suffering. The Buddha completely agrees that there is suffering, and his first noble truth, when you actually look at, I'll read it out to you because it's such a wonderfully concise and complete definition of suffering. Birth is suffering. Aging is suffering, disease is suffering, death is suffering. Grief, sorrow, lamentation, pain, and despair are suffering. Union with the unloved is suffering. Separation from the loved is suffering. Not getting what one wants is suffering. In short, the five groups subject to clinging are suffering. Now those five groups, the five aggregates subject to clinging, are the underlying, the fundamental building blocks of experience. The five aggregates are what everything is made of. This moment is the five aggregates. And just to mention them for you: materiality, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. It's the weaving together of these five groups that creates the reality that we all know and love. Love? Well, I'm not quite sure about that, but the reality that we all know. Now, the Buddha is saying that this underlying weaving of these five aggregates, the fundamental constituents of actual experience, are suffering. So that everything that is created out of those five groups is also suffering. Whatever we make out of those five groups will be suffering. Now this, in its own way, is for the ordinary person in the street, if you will, is a law of unforeseeable consequences. What drives the five aggregates is what we call kamma, which is volitional activities that are all taken with a view of self. So essentially what drives the continual production of these five aggregates, which are suffering, is the desire for life, the desire for existence, the desire to control, manipulate, and change life to make it as we want it to be. What we sum up in the word kamma. So to put what I'm trying to say very briefly is, our actions have results. But those results will always be made up of the five aggregates, and the five aggregates are suffering. But the Buddha also maintains that there is a complete cessation to suffering. But that cessation is the transcending of the aggregates. Not the manipulating of them, not the altering of them, not trying to make them what we want, but the transcending of them. Now, if you bear that in mind, it means that we cannot get rid of suffering through external means. There is no way that we can manipulate life and make it into something satisfactory, if it is that the five groups, the five aggregates, are indeed suffering. Whatever we try to do, however we try to manipulate, what we will create will be unsatisfactory. It will be suffering. So in order to free ourselves from this perpetual cycle of suffering, we have to work in an altogether different way than simply trying to correct all the apparent problems in the world. It takes inner work. It takes meditation in order to accomplish it. So am I therefore saying that we should all just sit in our chairs, close our eyes, gaze at our navel or our navel fluff, and just not give a monkey's about all the problems and difficulties in the world? Is that what the Buddha is saying? Because it's clearly it appears to be what these people are complaining about. Buddha laid down a path, the Noble Eightfold Path, that anyone can take in order to reach this transcending of these aggregates, to go beyond the world. It is a middle way. It is a middle way that avoids all extremes. Doing everything, taking up every last ounce of your energy and your life to help others is one extreme. To become completely self-obsessed with meditation and trying to find enlightenment for oneself without giving monkeys for anyone else, that is an extreme. The Buddha's teaching is a middle way between the extremes. And let me give you a couple of examples of what I mean about these two particular extremes. A few years ago, there was a story of a spiritual teacher and his wife, I think they were both spiritual teachers actually, in America, who, in the course of their spiritual teachings, set up a telephone answering service as a charity for people that are in crisis, so that people who are in crisis of one kind or another could talk to somebody who would be sympathetic and compassionate and would be able to give them advice and help and so forth. And I'm sure we'd all agree that's a lovely and very worthwhile thing to do. The charity got into financial difficulties, so they remortgaged their house and they gave away their life savings to the charity. And as time progressed, they both got ill with life-threatening illnesses. So they couldn't work, so they couldn't pay their mortgage. They had no life savings to fall back on. They became destitute as a consequence. They were looking after other people, but were they looking after themselves? So that's one extreme. Another extreme. A few years ago, we had a chap who used to come on retreat who was completely obsessed with finding enlightenment for himself. He would take no instruction. He would, if he came on, say, integrated retreat, he would be giving a work duty in the morning. He would rush round, fulfilling what he'd been asked to do quickly enough that he could get back outside to have a cigarette with his cup of coffee. So, and I saw this a number of times, that he would, a 40-minute work project would be finished in 15 minutes flat. You didn't want to be around him because it was just a blur of activity while he was doing it. But his whole emphasis, there was no thought given to why people on integrated retreat are given a work project to do. There was no thought that of service to others. There was merely the completion of an onerous task that was getting in his way. And that was a sort of a typical kind of attitude that he held. Reached a point with his meditation where he reached a complete block, that he could not meditate at all. And the reason was that his attitude was so selfish, so self-orientated. It was all about him and no one else. He became hard. You didn't want to be around him, angry man. He hit a meditative wall so hard that in the end he gave up meditating completely, left the centre. That's another extreme. What we teach here, and what the Buddha taught, is living by the precepts, moderation in all things, sense restraint. In doing those things, you become harmless to others and to yourself. And in addition, there's the development of wholesome activities. Generosity, service to others, patience, truthfulness, and of course, meditation itself. So you can see that The beauty of the Buddha's teaching is that it's so wonderfully balanced. It recognizes that, you think about it, if you spend your whole life trying to solve all the suffering in the world, at the end of doing all that, you've still got to start the journey to enlightenment. Right, enough said. So when it comes to the meditative path, the way through is to balance both others' welfare and our own. So now, what are these cruel aggregates and how do they oppress us? So the five aggregates are the fundamental building blocks of experience. And they are how life is actually constructed. Let me go through the five again. Materiality, feelings, perception, mental formations, and consciousness. Right now, right here, that is all there is. I was trying to find a way of putting across the immediacy of these aggregates, because the tendency is to sort of start thinking about them as intellectual constructs, and it becomes nothing more than an interesting philosophy. But it's not. It's real. It's dynamic. It's how existences weave together right now, sitting here in this shrine room. It's just, it's this. So let's have a look at these aggregates right now in terms of sitting here in the shrine room. What are they? Materiality. It's everything physical, both internal and external. So can you feel the tactile sensation as you're sitting in this chair? Can you feel the warmth coming from the radiators? This is materiality. Shape and colour to the sense of eye. The shape and colour of the shrine. Sound of the voice. This is the aggregate of materiality. Feelings. Is it a bit too stuffy and it's an uncomfortable feeling that you're feeling right now? Or is listening to Tamma calming you down and you're actually experiencing either an equanimous feeling or a pleasant feeling? Whatever the tone is, the flavour of the mind is at this moment, in turn, is it pleasant, is it unpleasant, or is it neutral? That's the aggregate of feeling. Perception. Perception is the labelling of the experience. So if the thought arises, I'm in a shrine room, listening to Brother Paul speak. Shrine room is perception. Brother Paul is perception. It's a label that we put on, or that mind puts onto the experience so that it knows what it is and what you're dealing with. Mental formations is a very wide, all-encompassing aggregate that includes literally the formations of the mind. So it's the various functions of the mind that allow ongoing conscious experience. Now that might sound a bit challenging, but essentially, to sit here, to sit listening to somebody talking requires attention. It requires one-pointedness of mind. They are mental formations. Determination. Volition. There had to be a volition earlier to get here tonight. You had to will. There had to be the willing, I will go to the meditation centre. That willing, that I will, is a mental formation. Concentration is a mental formation. And finally, consciousness. Some people have difficulty with consciousness, but essentially, you can divide consciousness into six by way of the particular sense. So, eye consciousness, seeing. Ear consciousness, hearing. Nose consciousness, smelling. And so it goes on. So it's hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and awareness of mind, mind consciousness. And that's it. The whole of what we call conventional reality is a weaving of these five aggregates. So how do these aggregates oppress us? They oppress us when we cling to them. They oppress us when we cling to them as being me, or mine, or myself. I was just talking to somebody in the break. We were talking about certain fears, worries and anxieties that come up in the mind, and we're both agreeing that the problem is when we identify with what's coming up as being me or mine or myself. We grasp after it, we cling on to it. Because we have this idea that it is either me or mine or myself, we believe that we can control and manipulate them. Because if it is myself, I should be able to do that. If it is me, I should be able, if my body is me, I should be able to just tell my body how to behave and it will behave. If it looks like it's going to get a bit of a cold, I should say, now body, no cold please, and it should do that. How many people can have that sort of power and control? Well, none of you. Can you control sound arising? Can you control the fact that it was cold today? Now you can do something in response, of course, but the aggregate suppresses because they are not solid and enduring. They're not controllable. They do not last. They are unreliable. They will always let us down. They are suffering. Now the whole object of vipassana is to actually observe this in real time, right now, and actually observe that that is the case. That we cannot control them. That they arise and pass away without any ownership, without any control. There's three aspects to this I wanted to look at, if I've got time. Conditionality, the serial arising of phenomena, and the serial dissolution of phenomena. Conditionality. Earlier today, I heard the lovely call of a blackbird, which this time of year is absolutely delightful. By about June, it's becoming a real, real pest. But when it first arises in the season, it's such a beautiful thing to hear. There is a sound. Because there is an ear and the sensitivity of an ear, consciousness can arise, which takes that sound as its object. Where there's no sound, there could be no hearing. I mean, it sounds obvious enough, but it's actually the case. Where there's no ear with which to hear, there could be no hearing. There could be no sound. The coming together of the sound, the ear, and the hearing is what we call sense contact. Contact of three coming together. Because there's contact, there is perception and pleasant feeling. Ah, blackbird, beautiful song. And there might be a response. You might, for instance, start singing a Beatles song. It has been known. Yeah? Because, now, if you sit quietly and simply observe what's happening, one happens after the other without any controller behind it. It just happens. One thing happens conditioned by the next thing, conditioned by the next thing, conditioned by the next thing. It's all happening without any ownership at all. And you have to have all those elements there for that experience to happen. If there is anything missing, like, for instance, the ear base is missing, then that experience could not have happened. Even the response could not have happened, because the response was conditioned by what came before it. Okay? So that's conditionality. The serial arising of the aggregates. As the mind gets calm and you're meditating, it starts to become obvious that there is one experience that is immediately followed by another experience, which is immediately followed by another experience, and you see this serial arising of phenomena again and again and again. Now, what that teaches us directly is that there is no control over what's going on, that there is no end to that process of continually arising phenomena, again and again, just arising and arising and arising. It also shows us that there can be no annihilation of a self, because there is no self in that experience, that these five aggregates are operating without anyone's permission. And further, and very interestingly, there is a direct inference that it's always been like this, that that is the way life is, the serial arising, independent of any self. And also, there's the recognition that it's always going to be like that in the future too, because that's exactly what life is like. So there can be no eternal anything. It is not possible to fix life in any one way. Okay, so what about serial dissolution? A little bit further on in the meditation, you start to become aware not of the arising of the aggregates moment by moment, you start to become aware that they're dissolving moment by moment, they're disappearing moment by moment. And you see quite clearly that it was always that like that in the past, it had to be, and it always will be like that. That there will be, for every arising, there will be the dissolution of phenomena, moment by moment by moment. Now in seeing that, you see that nothing is fixed, nothing is solid or eternal. Everything you make will break. And people can go through some fairly difficult times with the meditation, because that's seriously denting our view that life is going to be satisfactory. Because you see that out of anyone's control, life is just disappearing on you moment by moment by moment by moment by moment. All the meditators who reach this point come through happily, because they see that it is a result of their meditative experience. But what it does, and it does it so brilliantly, it makes you go, whoa, this is too much. How can I create a satisfactory life within these five aggregates that just keep disappearing, 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 disappearing? It's just not possible. And it's that scene that creates the, if you like, the springboard for looking elsewhere, for wanting to transcend this whole rotten mass, oppressive mass of five aggregates. Now, I know that life has its lovely side, and I'm not denying that at all. But when that lovely side disappears, how do you feel? The five aggregates are suffering. The Buddha likened the aggregates to, well, materiality as a lump of foam, feelings as a bubble, perception as a mirage, mental formations as the trunk of a banana plant, consciousness as a conjurer's trick, all empty, void, and without any substance. And he said, in the same way, a meditator sees, observes, and appropriately examines any aggregate that is past, future or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, common or sublime, far and near. And to the meditator, seeing them, observing them, and appropriately examining them, those aggregates appear empty, void, and without substance. And what are they empty of? They're empty of any controller, any self. This moment is just the unfolding of the aggregates, moment by moment. And if there's no clinging, no holding, no controlling, there's no problem. And so the whole path is about focusing in on now, in order to free you from clinging to these aggregates. Enlightenment is the transcending of the aggregates completely. I once heard an enlightened person say that the moment of discovery of the way life really was the discovery that there are no gaps anywhere. It is the total comprehension of the utterly interdependent nature of the aggregates. And because they are completely interdependent, you cannot separate them out at all. And because you can't separate them out at all, in that moment you are actually free of the aggregates. You are beyond them. Now this transcending is a transcending in understanding. It's not an elimination. But at the same time, when you have understood the way it really is, and you see that there are no gaps anywhere, so there can't be any things, so there can't be any aggregates, you are, at one at the same time, completely beyond them. Now, and Sariputta, the Buddha's chief disciple, said, the beauty of enlightenment is there are no contacts, there are no feelings, there are no perceptions. The enlightened being is completely beyond aggregates, is completely beyond suffering, is completely beyond the craving that causes the suffering. However, people see an enlightened being, or somebody who is purportedly to be enlightened, walking, talking, doing all the normal things. The Buddha himself taught for, 45 years, a sublime teaching that's lasted 2,500 years. There has to be something there. But what is it if the enlightened being is beyond the aggregates? Well, you don't expect me to answer that, do you? There is no way of communicating that. The Buddha used a logical device to help people to get their heads around this. He talked about there being nibbana, so nibbana, cessation of suffering, with the groups remaining, and nibbana without the groups remaining. And we talk about, say, an enlightened being having, they don't die, but there is a parinibbana, to differentiate the fact for the unenlightened being to differentiate, to try and make it sort of understandable that an enlightened being doesn't just disappear in a puff of blue smoke. But anyone who's actually realised knows full well that the aggregates belong to the dualistic world, to the unenlightened world, and they're completely beyond the aggregates. But you're going to have to find out for yourself, guys, because it's so difficult to put across. Okay, just a quick summary then. The problem of suffering cannot be eradicated externally. The very action is based in an ignorance of the way the world works and always has unforeseeable consequences. Such activity, laudable as it is, merely perpetuates the round of suffering indefinitely, and still one's own freedom is yet to be won. What is required is the wisdom to acknowledge this fact and to attend to one's own spiritual development. Walking the path to enlightenment includes within it a balanced approach to dealing with the needs of others. Indeed, the path cannot be completed without proper consideration for others. But in the final analysis, it is only by looking closely at how life is constructed moment by moment at its most fundamental level that the transcendental understanding that people call enlightenment can be realized and the aggregates left behind forever. Okay, thank you very much.